Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show. Welcome back. Today we conclude episode 116, where Catherine, Pedro, Greta, and Tom are discussing a book by Jeffrey Pfeffer and Gerald Solancik titled The External Control of Organizations, A Resource Dependence Perspective, published by Harper and Row in 1978. In part two, we consider the legacy of the book and its authors and why the ideas are still important today. If you missed part one, you can access it through our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We now rejoin the conversation.
So yeah, perhaps we can talk a bit about like how has this book been taken up in the field? My impression is that especially the later chapters that you also refer to, Catherine, have been picked up pretty well in discussions of corporate strategy, and Pfeffer and Solancik is often cited there. Another key message of this book, that activities inside the organization are inherently connected to what happens outside the organization and the interdependencies and constraints that organizations encounter, and how that shapes what happens inside the organization in terms of, you know, the way the organization is structured, how it operates, what work is being carried out, and how that is continuously shaped and changing by changes in the environment. I thought was a very powerful one, which perhaps has not gotten the attention that it deserves. And I would love to hear what your takes are on that.
Well, the first thing to say that's very interesting, that's one of the points that the author seems to be aware, is a methodological challenge or a point of inattention, because they talk about that exactly in chapter 9, and they say that, you know, we know already before, and we have been telling you for 8 chapters, that there is this interdependence between internal and external. What is the mechanism? It's not enough to just say that, right? And they go into this whole point about executive succession, which is a little bit of a sleight of hands at the last minute of the opera. You know, they all have lived happily ever after kind of thing. Oh, it's because executives are the hinge between these things. And there is, of course, much, much more. And this is something that one could have expected would have been further explored. But I think that it is, but not maybe in relation to this framework and with the same assumptions that they try to construct, as far as I'm aware, right? Because the assumption, unlike a lot of attention in the book to activities, to interpretation, is more about the features. So maybe just because methodologically that's easier to study, so particular features correlate with particular situations, and then we can see the prevalence. Or we can study, you know, the impact of a shock and how organisms readjust, but it's harder to see at the level of the, say, practice and the functioning of the organization, which they reference many times is important, how this interplay takes place. And again, maybe just because it's really hard to collect and analyze and get a comprehension of that level, it almost feels that something that would require a team or a program, a coordinated research program across different research, not even people, maybe even research groups, right? All this to say that it is both important, and I agree with you that it has not been taken up. And I think that it's one of the things that maybe there is room to think about how one could unearth the insights that are brought forward that have not been as much considered since the book.
I completely agree with you, Pedro. And it made me think about like a blog I read, and I'm sorry I forgot the author, but perhaps we can link it to the website, about how ChatGPT and some of these generative AI tools are changing the ways organizations work. First, think about like gatekeepers, like who is monitoring the environment? Often those are people in nominated positions or experts, and people trusted that they knew what these gatekeepers or experts were talking about. But now everybody can put a question in ChatGPT and get an answer. So, and everybody, like ChatGPT, is wired to them in different ways. Suddenly everybody has an opinion. So what is the impact of the changing environment? What is the impact of changing technologies through which we access the environment or think we can monitor or learn about it? There are a lot of implications there in terms of the way we do things. There are a lot of changes in terms of decision making happening now, how organizations absorb information, what the avenues are to monitor and access information. And I guess that also counts for the environment more generally. And what structures are set up in the organization when the activity of monitoring the environment can now be done in very quick ways that does not necessarily have to be segregated in a specified role? What does that mean in terms of the power people have inside organizations, because they know about external resources, they control external resources to bring in, and the way the organization operates? I feel like, you know, there are a lot of ways there is disruption happening there at this moment. And I think this book gives a nice framework to think those disruptions through.
Well, not only that, but also, what does ChatGPT do to the expectations of external actors on how an organization is going to behave? If there's an expectation, for example, that now organizations are going to become AI, or that the AI tools are out there, what happens if you're an organization that's a little slow in adapting to it? Well, I'm your stakeholder. I have this vision in my mind that AI is the greatest thing since sliced bread in solving all the world's problems. And I'm going to start switching my resources over to invest in some other firm over here who's embracing AI to the hilt. So then, if you're the organization, this is sort of like that balance between reactivity and proactivity. Okay, how do I reduce uncertainty introduced by this technology? How do I decide to try to keep the relations going with that external actor who might decide to cut ties with me at any moment? I appreciated that because it also helps to paint a different picture of how some of these new ideas get institutionalized, why people will tend to grab, like AI became a thing. So then everybody has to do AI, even though I would bet that many corporations, certainly many agencies, do not necessarily know what they are doing with AI or how best to use it, or maybe aware of the pitfalls and be scared to death of it. But they've got to get on board. Otherwise, they're going to be at some sort of a perceived disadvantage. And note, I said perceived, not actual.
There is a whole industry that's emerged on managing the uncertainty that comes with AI, I guess, in looking at what is the external environment that most companies are grappling with. And that is certainly on the horizon and a major threat to be managed, I guess. I think it's interesting, just on a practical level, to think about information and how managers manage information and the threat or the perceived threat that comes with new technology like ChatGPT and AI in general. There was always misinformation within organizations. So sometimes I think the fear that we have of people accessing more information, is that real or is it perceived? Obviously, the capabilities of what could be possible with AI can be used negatively, but they can also be used positively. What sometimes I see in practice is that the people in an organization who are most likely to embrace the uncertainty and actually engage with the uncertainty and try and stabilize it for the organization. So particularly with AI and ChatGPT, from personal experience, tends to be younger people in the organization seem to move forward to embrace it more wholeheartedly. And with that comes a lot of influence that is then responded to by management. And does that ever become power? I don't know. So can you, in terms of a career strategy, if you are seen to be somebody who embraces uncertainty, has capabilities to manage it, therefore become more influential, does that give you a certain power internally because of your ability to manage what's perceived as a more external threat on the environment?
What is the answer? Maybe the Pepper and Selesky's answer would depend on how the organization thinks about itself. I mean, they don't use those words, but this interpretation and the meaning and the way in which, you know, the meaning is retrospective and therefore the extent in which they're able to catch up, or as someone was saying, the way in which the external environment reshapes also and influences expectation, because going beyond this framework, right? And Tom was hinting at that, there are expectations, norms, schemas, which social theory people have talked at length about, that shapes expectations organizations have about the relevance, salience, impact of the environment on them. Also, ever since the book was published, all the research on management fashions, the more recent research on social evaluations, all add to this complexity, right? But one thing I wanted to say, going back to where Greta started on the change in environment, I think one thing we should not forget is that reality, social reality shaped also by eyes, and the book itself is certainly a way to shape reality, right? Because certainly the book and the movement that came after puts the environment on the agenda of consultants and managers, academics, podcasters, right? So there's also an impact on the way their environment is understood through the frameworks that are, you know, let's not forget, Pepper has taught for so many years at such a prominent business school like Stanford. So there's also an element of that. And the other one, so this is an element of reflexivity, right? How ideas also shape the way organizations function and the way leaders and managers also pay attention and not, because they have schemas based on research frameworks or scholarly frameworks or of some kind. But the other point I think is very important is that I was also surprised in reading the book to see how much reference they make to information systems. And as you all have been saying, nowadays we are also awashed with that, right? With multiple ways through which we can scan and get information readily and how that shapes how organizational functions.
I think it even goes beyond that, Pedro. It's not just information technologies to access information. It's also the way we now structure interorganizational relations. Like the book talks about joint ventures, associations, coalitions, cartels. But when you look at the way industry activity is organized now, we more and more see ecosystems emerging, groups of organizations that are interdependent. We have platforms emerging where, you know, you don't have to own a resource anymore or lend it from another. You can just temporarily access it. There are big changes happening by technology firms developing the infrastructure that kind of sets the rules for how these interorganizational relations are structured. And where it's not, when you think about interorganizational power, when you think about a platform model, it's not between the buyer and the supplier, but suddenly the platform owner starts to get a lot of power because they determine who can access the platform, who gets replaced, which is a very different model compared to the 1970s and 80s when this book was written. So I feel like it's not just the information technology or the technologies at hand. It's also the industry structures that are brought about that have big changes in terms of how we think about managing interdependencies, especially when they're asymmetric.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought it the ecosystem idea because, vertical integration was talked quite a bit in this book. But of course, that's something that is not very prevalent nowadays. And so in government, you're doing one whale of a bunch of outsourcing. And the outsourcing, it's based on, brings about competing ideas of the organization boundary. Pfeffer and Selancic look much, much bigger. And my reading of them is that, well, they are part of or inside the organization boundary because these outsourcing agencies are providing the services or performing the tasks on behalf of government. But there's also sort of like the liability-based view that looks at organization boundaries much more stringently. And when it comes to outsourcing, the two perspectives on where the boundary lies come into conflict, especially when it comes to
what happens when the service is ultimately not provided or not provided adequately, whose fault? And then the blame game starts and it's like, well, we outsourced it, so it's their fault. And the customer says, no, you're the one who did the outsourcing. It's your fault. All of the parts in which we're talking about how the organization tries to defend itself and manage these interdependencies that it can't avoid. I mean, government organizations right now, the way that we're structured, really do have to outsource so many of their tasks and services just because they can't manage the size of the organization on an internal payroll. So it kind of enlightens how conflict can come about and how sometimes, you know, these problems, as they do appear, become intractable. They become almost unresolvable, aside from just you almost have to go to court to get them resolved or whatever, because the defensive mechanisms that everybody establishes as a result of the need to manage dependency, to manage interdependence, to protect the organization to survive, makes it really difficult in complex systems to pinpoint the cause of an unsatisfactory performance. Do we want to get to the criticisms then?
One last thing, maybe, that is positive. Talking about conflict also made me think about the particular way in which the authors talk about interdependence, which again is such a central concept in organizational theory. Just think about our episode on Thompson and all the debate about coordination and task and all of that. And I think that by bringing power to the foreground, the idea of interdependence here is, like Tom was saying, based on necessity, stratagems, way that not just people are trying to collaborate and interface, but trying to get something. So it's about whether and how and through what means they're going to relate with each other to achieve something, right? So in, as we said in part one, moving the conversation from just how you reallocate resources, how you orchestrate the task, and how you know ensure this smooth flow of information, of inputs and outputs, it's also in terms of how do you get what you need without giving away too much? How do you able to exactly strategize? And all of this thing that Tom is talking about, potential conflict between different parties, made me think about the way in which interdependence is thought about in a particular way.
I think it also brings up going back to the AI and then thinking to other technologies that were shiny, new, and had a lot of promise, and then 5 to 10 years later, as the problems start to appear or people start to figure out how to manipulate them for ill will, et cetera, how then the whole, you know, the context shifts from, say, for some organizations, like you'll have conservative organizations who will shun or try to downplay the change and manage interdependence one way, manage how they relate to the external stakeholders one way. And then the aggressive ones who wind up becoming, their aggression becomes a vulnerability in the in later years, and how in their context, what made them strong suddenly causes them to perhaps become very, very weak. What this brings up to me, you know, it's very interesting to think about how the book describes what is the realm of strategies that are out there. The challenge then becomes, okay, how do you actually choose which strategy? They give indications based on what empirical evidence was given before. But then say, you know, as I put my consulting hat on and say, all right, I'm going to go into an organization and here's my reading of the context. How do I come up with the right advice based on what I read, you know, based on understanding what the context is? What do I take away from the context and what do others take away from the context? How do I advise them to make a better decision to respond to the situation as it is?
Yeah, I like what you're saying there, Tom. And it makes me think like, okay, like what are the implications of that context for organizations of different sizes, for instance? The response might be very different because large organizations have more resources that they can mobilize compared to smaller ones, but smaller ones can mobilize resources more quickly than larger ones. So that's like one of the things I'm thinking about. And the other one is like, the book is mostly focused on social context. And I think when you, for instance, look at technology firms, there is also a technological context now with technologies being built on top of other technologies. If you think about like how airplanes are being built, you have all these suppliers delivering parts. And that creates a lot of like either technological or material interdependencies, which are not necessarily social dependencies, but the performance of one part of the product is dependent on another one. For instance, in technology development, it's very normal to use third-party tools. So you don't have to write that piece of code yourself. But then what if that external party starts to stop supporting that piece of the product? Then your product doesn't function anymore. Similarly with cloud, if all organizations put their operations in the cloud, when the cloud service like AWS is down or Microsoft Azure, all these companies face the performance issues in terms of their operations. So I feel like this is a part of development that has happened where we massively jumped on cloud computing. We massively jumped on, we focus on our core business, everything else we will outsource, creating all these kind of either material or technological interdependencies in terms of what we make, not just how we make it and the contracts there. You know, the role of contract is also very different nowadays with these ecosystems where it's all about reputation and it's not about contractual agreements anymore, but that's a side note. I think the types of interdependencies have become more varied. And I wonder to what extent the strategies that Faber and Slensic developed for managing social interdependencies are also applicable for these other ones. And I think that's a whole area of research that we can look into and think about. Like, definitely they give us a framework for thinking about it. But I feel like in terms of inter-organizational relations, asymmetric dependencies and power, it might be a little bit too simplistic. And what the consequences are for management and what is asked from them, it might be a more complex environment that managers are facing today compared to the 80s.
So one is this shift of scale or novelty. But in talking about these new interdependencies, it also brought forward to me the fact that there's a dark side in the story. And they talk a little bit about that when talk about collusion and threading the line between one or the other. But you are bringing it more to the foreground and say that one, you know, some of the examples you were talking about, platforms before, these in a way are setting up the infrastructure of the context that some people kind of, you know, own the commons, so to speak, in this more metaphor, right? That the common infrastructure that we take for granted that, yes, there is all of this scheming happening and the organization is interdependent, but, well, some people are managed to structure how they meet in the first place and whether do they meet. So then things start to change because it's no longer, and was never, but even less of a common playing field, because the assumption that the government is there, which the book has a little bit to, you know, guard and establish clear rules for everyone, is eroded when everything happens in a different space that is governed by complete different actors, which basically own it, right? From social media to the liberal market platforms, whatever, right? So that is this invisible control of the environment or invisible shaping or construction of the environment, right? Has a big impact. Of course, we all talk about that. You just opened any newspaper, there is some article on this, but I never thought about that through this framework. Right, that the playing field has been changed in the way in which all of the interdependencies always happened have been shaped in ways that we don't perceive, right? And there's all sorts of bias and problems and politics with big P and small P being played. The other one, I think, about the technological environment also brings vulnerabilities, which becomes very clear. You know, putting this together with what also Tom said before about the outsourcing, this is sometimes not just that, you know, I had a suboptimal product, but I use third-party code, and therefore there is some kind of vulnerability there, and then that leads to a cyber threat, right? To major disruption of services, right? We put everything digitalized and we forget, okay, and now we've put like society-critical infrastructure in the cloud, then what happens if, you know, we cannot access important data and so on? So there's also this other side of these interdependencies and the change in the way we are working together with each other and the tools that we use that also, especially in a time of so many wars, right, becomes important to think about vulnerability and resilience and how the interdependence in the context shapes one's vulnerability as an organization.
So given the complexities of the times, which you've outlined brilliantly, we need a scapegoat at the head of the organization or managing the organization to deal with it when they make the wrong decisions and it all goes horribly wrong.
What I was going to say was that, since we're getting into the wars, you know, if there was one thing about the environment that perhaps was underrepresented in the 1970s, or at least was not really the focus of what they're talking about, is the presence of malign actors who are actually stakeholders in the organization. I would say that there was nothing in the book that told me that this would not be a natural extension to the framework that they present to account for stakeholders or actors who are very definitely influential in an organization whose purpose, very purpose for being, is to sink the organization. Whether it is to destroy the organization utterly as an existential threat or to denigrate the organization so that the malign actor appears more powerful. This was one of the subjects of a study I did, a case study I did on communication campaigns, strategic communication campaigns in an organization that stood up in a hostile environment where there were malign actors who were saying that this organization is a bad idea, it should not exist, and actually had some pretty legitimate, mostly legitimate reasons why their methods of trying to enact those objections were not necessarily legitimate. But disinformation, you know, we talked before about misinformation. Disinformation is just an extension of it. It's misinformation with purpose. And it's something that we are now very well attuned to here, that now organizations, like, again, the framework kind of offers a clue, you know, a good clue to how organizations deal with that. Because disinformation is just simply something else that introduces uncertainty into the environment. It has reputational impacts. It has all of the things that are covered in the book. And so then it just simply becomes one additional layer of something that an organization, that leaders, managers have to contend with. But the extent to which they have to contend with is certainly far beyond what was considered in the 1970s. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there were malign actors throughout history, but I don't recall encountering that in any of the literature that we've been exploring before the 1990s.
Yeah, especially in terms of reputation, right? Like, it's so easy to now put something on social media, write a one-star Google review, and thinking about like how reputation has become such an important form of capital for organizations, influencing, you know, their business. That is a big change compared to the 70s and 80s. And another thing I would love to get your thoughts on is, you know, this idea of managerial discretion. Like, is that still the same? What do we think about like how management and governance structures have evolved? Previously, when you wanted to start a business, you went to a bank and you got some funding, or you didn't. Now you have all these shareholders that you have to satisfy when you go public. So the organizational context has become more complex and perhaps diversified. But then also, like, what room do management teams have to respond to it?
Can I just answer the bit about the one-star review first? Is it not surprising to anyone that firms have found new and interesting ways to try to game the rating system, to pay people to plot, you know, and now we've got the platforms are turning around and trying to come up with anti-gaming technology. I mean, that's just all.
So interesting, I feel that the answers are in the book for this, right? So we talk a little bit about what is beyond, but actually I'm trying to make the effort of, okay, what do we would say, having read the book and talked about it? For the first, they have very interesting things to say about performance measurement and the unintended consequences that exist, and they draw on the work of Blau and many, many others, that once you start, you know, I think they talk about the work of Blau in an employment agency that once you start being measured by how many people you interview and reallocate into a new job, then people don't even care about the quality of this, you know, finding the jobs that they find for people that are unemployed. It's just like maximum quotas. And I have other examples as well. So the gaming and the reputation, to some extent, it's also different, has this similar element of a new type of performance that is measured. But interestingly, as you're saying, Greta, is also something that is done by clients, right? So it's not internal. It's about, you know, getting the attention and the support and the validation of the people external, right? As for financialization, because I think that's what you're pairing managerial discretion against, right? We know that has had such big impact. Many people have written about that, but they somehow, and I can't remember if it's in the preface, I think maybe it's in the preface, that they say, well, we have an answer a little bit for that, right? That also, if you start looking at the different actors and their interests and how accountants maybe colluded together with some organizations, I think they have the case of Enron, right? To kind of, you know, don't pay close attention to the book. So some of this stratagemas that are taking place are also taking place in this financialized capitalism. But of course, what is also happening is that maybe the interdependencies are also pulverized a little bit more, or are the domination of a particular set of actors is bigger in this balance. And we talked about the technology vendors and platforms, but that also there is the one of the financial stakeholders, right? That seems to have a bigger pie. So this environment that was, it was never described as being totally symmetrical, but there was a sense that it was a more of an open battlefield, right? But now you see very clear peaks and valleys and very clear owners of pieces of this land, so to speak.
That's a good point, Pedro. And it also then poses the question, like, who decides how to respond? And when that is, you know, a bunch of shareholders telling you what to do, what parts of the environment do they attend to? And is that really where, as an organization, your biggest constraints are? In terms of managerial discretion, that was where I was thinking, like, how does that affect who perceives the environment? How do they perceive the environment? And how do they exercise their power to force you to respond in the way they want to? And what impact does it have on the organization? And for instance, in more tech industries, we now see that some tech companies decide not to go public anymore exactly for this reason, because they feel that staying private and being able to decide as a management team, understanding your technology and what you're building, gives more freedom for them to respond to what is needed most than going public and suddenly having to deal with a whole bunch of other people that you are dependent on for resources.
I think it's really interesting to think about dependency. If, I don't know, it was a criticism of the book from my perspective would be that, yes, the whole focus of it is dealing with dependencies on the external environment, but you can't completely dismiss internal dependencies as part of the picture as well, because they absolutely affect everything every day as well and need to be taken in as part of the mix.
I mean, thinking of internal, external, and the extent to which you are owned, that's what Greta was also saying. I cannot not think about the case of Boeing, right? That is so in the news lately. Maybe hopefully by the time this podcast goes out, right, thing will look different, but it has been not looking very nice, right? And every week there's a new discovery. And again, to some extent, one can explain what happens in terms of an engineering culture that was eroded, regulatory agencies that have delegated too much, any forms of collusions happening. But again, if you bring the framework, some of the things start to make sense in a particular light, right? In terms of competition and financialization, and to what extent who is making the decisions that you're saying, Greta, internally and externally, and how much leeway you still have. And one expect, in this case, not high-tech digital, but complex manufacturing engineering, the experts are leading and they have their voice, and internally they're able to exercise discretion also to make decisions. But it might be that things are different. And here again, comes the framework. And there is a lot of discussions on the book in terms of how particular board, the case they're looking usually at the top, because that's where they look mostly in trying to look at the interface of internal and external, but we can apply to this, the whole organization, who is staffing the roles, right, of CEO and others, and extend in time, particular coalition and groups are able to argue and convince that they are more important than others. So if in one time it might be engineering, given the complexity of the operations, maybe if the problem is trying to get the money, then maybe, you know, accountants and financiers become more relevant. Or if the problem is potential legal action, then lawyers. So there's also this point in which what kind of expertise is guiding the organization and what ways in which the environment controls not just the managers, but also the voice of expertise that is guiding decision making here as well. With, as we saw in the case of Boeing, huge and sad consequences as well.
I think it also says a lot about the Boeing situation. There's one vignette that took away. We had the CEO, I think it was the CEO, who physically showed up at the plant. And this is a CEO who had not ever actually stepped into operations. I probably have that story a little bit sideways, but it does remind me of, you know, maybe not managerial discretion. It's probably, well, I guess it is discretion, because it's discretion about how they apply their time. And the extent to which, as organizations become more interdependent and complex, in essence, how much more expectations there are that managers focus up and out as opposed to down and in. And it's certainly in my area in government, the senior leadership is almost exclusively focused up and out. There's very little expectation of them doing anything down and in. That's delegated to the second tier of management in the agency. And the problems that has for keeping, you know, handling internal crises, it clearly is disadvantageous doing that, because then, you know, in times of crisis, that's one of those times when the single leader, the single CEO, really becomes the focal point. And what that person does determines, more so than in any other time, whether or not the organization is going to survive. Maybe not survive in the sense of whether it stays or goes away, but whether its reputation is so deeply harmed that it takes extraordinary effort to get to right the ship. And I guess I'm just kind of wondering if nowadays, coming out of the pandemic with a lot of internal issues ongoing about return to work policies and all of the things going on there, as there become, are we identifying an imbalance that perhaps this framework can help us understand as to where managers really should be devoting their time, or perhaps that the management team is not properly organized to handle both the interdependencies on the outside and the increasing complexity of the internal environments, if that makes sense.
Stafford does, and Solantic offer some, you know, some ideas in terms of designing externally controlled organizations in Chapter 10, after they talk about the management as well, that could be helpful. And just going back to what you said earlier, Tom, about as a consultant, if you're going into an organization, you know, what can you say to people? What can you take from this framework? And perhaps scanning the environment is one of them. As you said, post-pandemic, there's a lot of internal focus in organizations around work policies and how internally things are. Almost, I wonder sometimes, is it in response to having to suddenly, for some organizations at least, who weren't externally focused, become so externally focused on the threat of the pandemic, there's more focus internally. But, you know, scanning the environment, there's some interesting insights in this chapter again about, you know, how our short-term view of how we scan and the focus, particularly in most organizations, businesses, of which the vast majority are small and medium-sized enterprises, is on accountants and accountancy and the financials of the organization, but very, very little view of the long-term as well. We all feel at the moment is on motivations and type of work internally. So I think if you were to take something from it as consultants, is perhaps, given how people are responding to things in a very internal way at the moment, is this is a helpful framework for us to look a bit more outward again and a bit more externally. I'm talking mainly about kind of small and medium-sized organizations rather than bigger organizations than that.
And perhaps for big organizations, less this inside out, I'm going to think in terms of vertical, right? What is like on the top and what is done, you know, in the daily operations. There is also a segmentation, I want to say horizontally, about the multiple goals and then the multiple coalitions that are taking place. Because one of the things that maybe we also see today, and maybe the book was not so concerned with, that the stakeholders outside has just mushroomed from sustainability. We talk a lot about technical change and potential threats. So we can talk about resilience in general, to social change or social demands, about quality diversity, which hint even at things about return to work policies and motivation, right? So whatever organizations are trying to do internally is multidimensional, because something as how much can we work from home, right? It's also in terms of what is the problem of secrecy of files and the technical vulnerability it brings and what kind of impact it has to the development of skills that are going to be needed to be retrained in light of technological change, and the ability of people to create synergies and share and maybe erode personal boundaries and issues of trust and create collectives in which are able to, you know, to collaborate in a way that includes voices that sometimes are silent. So all of this is very also segmented internally, which is also perhaps one of the reasons why we have the expansion of the C-suite, right? So in light of applying the framework, it's interesting, there is a very relevant book here, which is by Jose Luis Alvarez and Sives Virginova, the Chinese C-suite, that they talk a little bit exactly about how these new roles are continually popping up, right, at the C-suite, and they seem to reflect social demands and fashions and all sorts of things, and they seem to perform a symbolic role to showcase the organization is paying attention to that. But then there is the problem of the coordination across all of these roles in terms, if we design a policy that allows for hybrid work, we will have to consider sustainability, resilience, diversity, welfare. I mean, you name it, right? So there is also that challenge, which the book allows to see, and in a way have only become more salient and important nowadays.
Yeah, I had a half-baked thought about, you know, how Elon Musk is running its businesses, but I don't have much to say about it. But where you see that he integrates everything, he wants everybody to work on site, he wants to own the entire supply chain. Like when you think about electric cars, he has his own chargers. So in terms of managing interdependencies, we see very different models emerging in markets. Some are completely reliant on the environment, and other organizations want to own everything. They withdraw from that model. I'm just very curious where it will go in the future. That was my very half-baked thought.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated, as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you when we present another classic reading on organization theory or management science here on Talking About Organizations.